This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Idea Podcast for June 21st. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. And once again, we have a very special guest with us on our show. Today, we have Barbara Zavon. Barbara is the Chief Risk Officer at Ontario Teachers' Pension Plan and co-author of a recently published report on sustainable finance. So we'll be talking with Barbara about the report, but the first item on the agenda, Jackie, is to talk about the TMX approval.
Yes, so Liberal Cabinet green-lighted the TMX and addressed deficiencies found by the court last August.
Yep.
And so they decided that they would go ahead with it, but they are making some changes, strengthening some conditions to address Indigenous concerns that they learned from their recent consultation. They talked about using the tax profit from the pipe, or I guess it wouldn't be profit, but the tax that they generate from this project.
Well, actually, it is a profit because the government owns the pipeline, so they're going to use the profits to plow it back into the renewables and other clean energy.
Yeah.
And actually, it's somewhat relevant to our guest, Barbara, today because the money is going to go into sustainable projects.
And clean energy, right? And they are talking about maybe potentially looking at Indigenous ownership of the pipe, but that hasn't been sorted out yet.
So green light. Back to where we were before the court decision last year. So when do we expect shovels in the ground?
Well, Ian Anderson spoke this week saying probably flowing by mid-2022. And I think that's important. You know, if you look at the reaction in Calgary, I would say there's some skepticism. You know, it's good news, but cautious because we still feel like, you know, until we see pipe going in the ground.
Show me the pipe. Right.
Yeah,
okay.
There's concerns about that. But I would say, you know, I think it's really positive. If you want to revisit, I think it's, I did this. I re-listened to our podcast with Ian on April 5th when he came on our show. And when we asked him, you know, what do you do if you get judicial challenges as you go forward? His answer was they would evaluate them when they arise, but they would continue to proceed with construction until they have some injunction that would stop construction. So, you know, it seemed that we'll probably see things go here. And yeah, of course, there could be some unknowns, it's positive.
I think it'll be by September we'll start to see some action. But let's go to Barbara and talk about sustainable finance and the report that was just recently written. So welcome, Barbara.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the report and what was it that spawned the federal government to commission the report?
Yeah, I think a few things really kind of fed into it. So before I started on the panel, I heard Honorable Minister McKenna, you know, she spoke to the significant investments that need to take place to ensure a smooth transition. So she kind of coined it, you know, we need to take billions to trillions. And I just want to put out there, like, first, finance is not going to solve climate change, but the things that will, so innovation, the clean electricity, energy-saving buildings, you know, all require investment. And a lot of investment. And that's where finance is absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm.
Challenging the financial sector expertise, ingenuity, the influence that it has toward the challenges and the opportunities that are poised by climate change.
Yeah. So the expert panel was you and three others. And actually, the report, we're going to post that, right, Jackie?
Yes, yeah, it's a public report.
It's an expert panel on sustainable finance, mobilizing finance for sustainable growth. And it's really important because, you know, Jackie, you and I have talked so much on our podcast about it's not just about technology. It's not just about costs coming down. At the end of the day, energy is a very intense business. And if we're going to facilitate any sort of transition, it requires a lot of capital. That's what this report is about. It's about catalyzing more capital to come into the space and also about better ways to deploy that capital to ensure that we get to the goal, which is ultimately to reduce emissions.
Right. And you recently wrote an article about the gap in terms of where we need to be and how much spending is going into green energy. And it's not where it needs to be. And so I think this is a great report. Everyone should read it. That's why we're having Barbara on the show. And I want to also mention that Barbara was one of four authors, but the authors had various backgrounds. So from pension funds like Barbara, but also large banks, federal government, finance, Bank of Canada. So really impressive group of people that worked on these recommendations.
Yeah. You want to talk about fiduciary duty. That is something that comes up in this report. So Barbara, can you tell us what fiduciary duty is?
Yeah. So I'll use my organization as an example. So I work for the Ontario Teachers Pension Plan, and we manage the monies for over 300,000 teachers who are in the classroom or retired. And so as part of our fiduciary duty, we need to act in the best interest of our plan members, so these teachers. And one of the challenges that we observed with this area was maybe because of how this area evolved. And there's a lot of acronyms, and, you know, I'll just, you know, this SRI, CSR, ESG, responsible investing, it had a ton of different names. And so, and this, I think, led to a lot of confusion about what do people really mean when you talk about incorporating environmental and social factors and climate change into business decision making. So we wanted to be clear from a panel point of view of what we meant is when you think about what could happen to a value of an asset, you know, what could go wrong, all the risks that could have significant or what is referred to as material impact should be considered. And these would include these environmental and social and governance considerations. And this might be a bit surprising to a lot of folks, and especially globally, like you've talked before on your show about the principles of responsible investment, and there's over 2,000 signatories who've committed to doing this already. But when you go to smaller and mid-sized players, it's definitely not 100% clear. And we think there's real value to clarify this and then also provide guidance of what does good look like when you're incorporating these factors.
So one of your recommendations was that the government should clarify that fiduciary duty does include climate change factors. So the government coming out and saying that that's required, how does that change that compared to what happens today?
Yeah, so I think people are looking for clarification. And so given Canada has quite a federated model with regard to regulators, it's really hard to change one act or one piece of regulation and say, this is what it means. So we thought, you know, what would be easiest is, you know, the government comes out and provides that clarity, and then they can work through the messaging through the regulatory system and have people change, you know, work with the provinces and hopefully change the corresponding acts that we all govern under.
Okay, so it would kind of make it more of a mandatory, where today it's a voluntary thing to sign up to UNPRI and say you're going to include climate change in your go-forward investment decisions.
Yeah, in a way. Like, I think many organizations are already doing it because they see the value of it. And I think really what we're hoping is that when people hear the message, we start providing guidance through the use of a stewardship code, for example, in Canada, that they'll gravitate and say, hey, we can do this. I now understand what they mean and put the pieces in place within their organizations.
So stewardship code is sort of like a set of guidelines, which right now is pretty fuzzy.
That's right.
Yeah.
Canada
yeah.
doesn't have one like many other countries do.
Yeah, I think any sort of clarity on these sorts of things is really important because there's just a lot of fuzzy areas. It's a new area, really. I mean, we talked about it on our ESG with Pat Bryden a few weeks ago. And this really is further clarification in your report of this big mega trend that's happening in terms of the financial world. And, you know, a lot of your report is on the need for financial products, financial securities, things like green bonds and ETFs, in other words, exchange-traded funds, which is a basket of equities, fixed income products, and so on. So you're trying to unlock dollars to come into these new types of products that are, you know, notionally under the umbrella of being green. And I guess our question to you is, well, sort of green, you know, is it just green or there's 50 shades of green? Like, what does it mean to be green?
Yeah, it's a tough question still because it is an area that's still evolving. So, you know, there are green bond principles today that are published and people have been using them. And, you know, they will refer to things like renewables being green, renewable energy. Mm-hmm. You know, new construction that meets certain criteria would qualify as green. And then people can issue green bonds relative to these and people will know it's going to projects that will make a difference. Now, the challenge is that, you know, there's many initiatives going on right now globally. Probably one of the more significant ones is the technical expert group in Europe, and they were set up last year in the summer. And they're working through phases, and I think phase one will actually be out soon. And they're going to initially focus on what's very green. But interestingly, they recently actually announced that they will include some transition activities. So they're starting to exhibit shades of green. Mm-hmm. And then in Canada, you're actually now seeing the Canadian Standards Association group is focusing on starting a similar effort in Canada. And we also think that there's a really unique opportunity for Canada to lead in the development of what we're calling a transition taxonomy for the global world in terms of, you know, what are the things that won't truly meet the green criteria that in some of our traditional sectors like oil and gas, but could still have a huge impact in reducing emissions.
So for example, Barbara, would that mean, here's a great example, we have all these opportunities to reduce methane in the oil and gas industry, which are really meaningful. Like in Canada, we're about 50 megatons, which is a big number associated with methane. And so there's a lot of investment needed to remove those emissions. And so could we get some funding from a green bond to help with the financing of that?
So I don't think in the pure green bond world that would be green, but I think as you see these, as Peter said, 50 shades of green, in this transition taxonomy, that would be one of the goals, would be how do we actually help our sectors like oil and gas with these projects that would have substantial emission reductions and a way for them to access the fixed income market.
Yeah, I think it's important because, you know, as we've talked about before, Jackie, that if you have a dollar to spend, you want to spend it on the things that make the greatest impact most quickly, and certainly reducing methane, which is, what, 30 times more?
Actually, on a 20-year time scale, it's 70 times more impactful than CO2 and has a much greater impact in a short time on warming.
So one would think that you want to encourage investment to that kind of thing. Now, you in the report, you recommend for these green investment products that people, whether at a retail level or an institutional level, if they invest in, say, a green bond, that they would get a super tax deduction. What do you mean by a super tax deduction?
Maybe it's the easiest to explain it through an example. And I'll just make up some numbers. So I'm not committing the government to use my math. But, today, if you have a Canadian citizen who makes roughly $50,000, mm-hmm. and they take $2,000 and they invest it into a registered savings plan, so for their retirement, for example, they're taxed on $48,000. Mm-hmm. The $2,000 isn't taxed, but it's taxed later when they take it in their retirement years. Under our super deduction scenario, let's take that same individual, $50,000, they put the entire $2,000 into green products. And let's say the factor is 1.5. Instead of subtracting $2,000, we would subtract $3,000, so 2 times 1.5. Hmm. So they would only pay tax on $47,000 today, and then that $2,000 later in the retirement years. So there's an immediate benefit to the individual. And that's what we're hoping that this will do, is Canadians will notice this, and they would first and foremost think, this is a way for me to be part of the solution,
right?
An opportunity for me to contribute. And then they're going to start asking questions of, to their providers, and therefore their providers are going to be motivated to increase their expertise and then get educated about sustainability. And then hopefully this demand drives this supply of green bonds and transition bonds.
So the arbiter of these sorts of things, in other words, the people tasked with defining green. So, it's really easy to define numerically the tax benefit, but defining what is green is still sort of the issue. So you've recommended a couple of new institutions be formed, the Canadian Sustainability Finance Action Council and the Center for Climate Information Analytics, because you need data to understand all these things if you're going to effectively price it in a new security, right?
Yeah, so they're going to be quite different. So the Sustainable Finance Action Council. So this is really supposed to be a public-private council, really there to help with advisory and facilitate movement for the Government of Canada. So they're going to be a super important connection to the private sector, who can be the best source of industry and market insight. And so, our recommendation is to pick leaders who are well-connected and who can provide them this insight and also help them, when they have an issue, say, in clean tech or would like some insight, they have the immediate network to say, you should talk to so-and-so. And so we really hope that they pick these leaders and, they're thinking through that. The other organization is what we call C3IA, which is around the Canada Centre for Climate Change for Data and Insight. And really we wanted to say that this really needs to be a member-based organization. So what do I mean by that? So this would be where private industry would coalesce together, co-fund this initiative that actually is probably one of the most prevalent issues we heard across the board in every sector was the challenge of bringing data together and then translating it to financial analytics. And so this would be member-run, member-governed, mm-hmm. With the support of some government funding. So really the governance would be on, which members join this organization.
you know, a big part of the report was talking about better disclosure around risks associated with climate change at a company level. Would this group be creating more of that data to understand the broad environment that the company might be operating in 20 years under? Would you consider how climate could change over that time frame?
Absolutely. And I think there's a real advantage if you bring together all this expertise, whether it's, you know, it could be from the climate sector, it could be from the business sector, because it's really a cross-industry issue, and you really need to bring the multifaceted skill sets together. And I think, you know, really getting to what are the insights that business needs to make decisions is really the crux of what we're trying to solve.
So the Task Force on Climate Financial Disclosures, sometimes it's called TCFD.
Yeah, I know a lot of people throw that acronym around, TCFD. TCFD is kind of a hard one, but it's what is it?
It was started as an effort by the Financial Stability Board, which is an international body that looks at, you know, really big systemic risks, and they make recommendations for countries to follow. And they thought, you know, if people reported on climate change, it would spur organizational thought on how to manage climate change and also to seize the opportunities. So they created a framework, which is really, you know, code for how should information be organized, you know, what information should be included. You know, they suggested some metrics related to carbon footprinting that should be included. And really, you know, when you look at this, most important challenge and a big part of their recommendation is the creation of scenarios. So under this scenario, how will a company fare? So it's really about disclosure and transparency. And, you know, the unique thing about it is they asked not just companies to report in this framework, but also asset owners like Ontario Teachers.
Who governs TCFD?
So TCFD is an international body, so it would be central bankers. So today it's headed up by Mark Carney and would have other participants of that ilk. And they're trying to think through what are the things that we need to put in place in this world to manage systemic risk. And their origin came after the global financial crisis, when most of us will remember that. And a lot of recommendations came from them on how to change our markets to be more stable after that event. So in a way, they're trying to be proactive with climate change.
Right. And so the idea is that you have to sort of talk about it. And today you're starting to see for publicly traded companies, these are voluntary reports that some are starting to come out in Canada. For example, I just read Imperial Oils. I think TransCanada has one out. Enbridge is getting one soon. But right now they're really focused on looking at whether it be demand for oil if you're Imperial and how they would look when demand for oil may go down in a 2-degree world. But I think what your report was saying is actually it's got to be a lot broader. There's a lot of other risks to a business beyond demand for your product. So am I right in that it was recommending that this actually is not maybe as voluntary? It's actually more mandatory. It's part of financial statements instead of sort of a side report, and that it is more broad in terms of looking at the whole business and the effects of the climate on it.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, it's voluntary, so FSB can't require anything on us. But every country then has to say, how am I going to choose to implement this? And the whole goal is to have climate change reported no different than any other risk that that company faces, and to really think holistically about, you know, what are the impacts it may have. It could be product demand, it could be legal risks, it could be the physical risks of where the company has their particular operations. So it is meant to be expansive in thinking through the impacts.
How does this make people invest more money in this space?
Yeah, so I think it's, you know, that's a really good point. And we talked about that a lot on our panel. And we thought it was a really great opportunity for companies to kind of, you know, take this. And we often hear from companies about all the reporting they have to do and the effort that it requires. And we're really hoping that companies will actually see this as an opportunity, you know, an opportunity for them to communicate on all the activities that are being undertaken in their organizations to manage the risk. You know, often when we talk to them, there's lots going on that you weren't aware about. And so we're hoping that they realize that, you know, silence on their part is actually investors are filling in the gap and they're assuming the worst. So really, we're encouraging companies to tell their story and switching their mindset that that's actually a positive thing and the ability to change in aggregate Canada's brand on this issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to get clarity on all this stuff. Again, a few weeks ago, we had Pat Bryden from Scotiabank and talking about the public companies and all the work that's been done that demonstrates that companies that do have an ESG, environment, social, governance focus, do perform better. And that what you're really trying to do here is a made in Canada set of parameters that are clear, well-defined, so that investors can take a look at it. Hopefully not too bureaucratic and burdensome in terms of the reporting requirements. And, you know, in the ideal world, you wouldn't have to give a tax credit, right? Like it's just like we know that companies that abide by these sorts of principles are a better place to invest. You know, but Jackie, I do take your point. Like why would I invest in it? And it's still fuzzy.
The idea I had actually, Barbara, is if you make a lot of, including some of these industrial or natural resource sector type companies report at this level, mm-hmm. it sort of forces them to think more about these issues. And they themselves probably will invest more so that they can kind of have some things to say in terms of reducing their mm-hmm. future risk associated with carbon emissions or changing climate. So I think it actually could generate some investment by these big companies more than would be if they weren't reporting.
Mm-hmm.
That is actually the raison d'etre for the disclosure. It's actually to help spur the organizational change that's needed, both at asset owners and companies.
Right, and the awareness that it creates. But that awareness brings me back to this idea, what we call it, the 50 shades of green. The idea that, for example, a basket of oil and gas company stocks that investors can buy, and imagine that these oil and gas companies have either achieved or aspirationally are going to drive towards net zero. So the question that I would have is if you created an exchange-traded fund, an ETF of a basket of such stocks, would that qualify for the super tax deduction? Because that would create awareness that, you know, there's differentiation between different players, whether it's in oil and gas or mining or any of these other industries.
Yeah. So in our report, we did recommend that as the transition taxonomy is built out, that it should be included into the super tax deduction. So we're recommending that a group through that Action Council get together to say, you know, what is the accreditation program? What does it look like? And definitely, you know, think about the other shades of green or the transition taxonomy as part of that conversation.
What is transition taxonomy?
Yeah, so it's kind of our term, and it's kind of being a term towed around a little bit to kind of say, look, these are products that we need as part of the transition. They're not green in terms of, say, no emissions. A transition taxonomy can help identify activities, just as you said about the methane, to really help reduce emissions in traditional sectors like fossil fuels, for example.
Okay, so it's like a broader recognition by some regulatory body that certain categories of investment
make sense. Yeah, it's a categorization of all the opportunity set for carbon reduction through greater investment.
Right. I want to come back to, Peter talked about net zero oil and gas, just so in case people don't understand the definition of that. But there are some companies in the oil and gas sector today that are saying they want to get to net zero, which means that all the CO2 emissions they create, they would actually offset those either by planting trees or injecting carbon into reservoirs or various other activities. So that makes sense to me. If it's a product that doesn't have an impact in terms of its net CO2 emissions, mm-hmm. I hope it will get into that taxonomy.
I think so.
Right. And the idea would be that, you know, today maybe that's not possible. So the transition taxonomy would say, you know, this criteria is what qualifies. And then over time, as these things get developed, the bar is raised to really encourage people to go and implement those things.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about this transition to the low carbon economy within the context of being inclusive and just. You know, I put those in quotes because it's in your report, and that inevitable disruption, basically away from fossil fuels, has to be inclusive and just. Can you talk about that? Because, you know, this is a new term that's starting to emerge in the vernacular of the energy transition, a just transition. Can you clarify that a little bit?
Yeah, so it's an effort that's, or a term that's being coined from the London School of Economics. And it's really thinking about the impact on communities, people, that aspect of climate change. You know, as you know, some communities will fare better than others. And so it's not going to be an equal transition across a country or globally. And so the way that we tried to think about it was that, you know, a lot of these reports done by other countries, they really didn't tackle the pillar 3 in our report, where we talked about products and markets that needed to be developed. And so one of the reasons we went deeply into oil and gas and retrofit and infrastructures, these are areas that are particularly important for Canada to really support that notion of a smooth transition or a just transition.
Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of just, I mean, just for further clarity, so for example, let's say a high emitter industrial plant like cement plant. So you're talking about communities that are dependent upon, say, the local big cement plant that all the workers get thrown out of work because we're transitioning away from cement to some other product. Or in the oil business, we're transitioning away from oil and a whole bunch of oil field workers get thrown out of work. Is that what we're talking about?
Absolutely. You know, I was in London doing interviews for the panel once, and, you know, I opened the paper and it was talking about a particular automaker closing 4 plants of the, you know, traditional cars and opening only 1 battery factory.
Mm-hmm.
And that causes big ripple effects in those communities.
Well, it does. It has political ripple effects too. So I'm glad that, you know, this term is coming into the vernacular, because it's, as we've said so many times on the show, it's not just about technology and sort of the raw numbers of finance and stuff. There are social costs that have to be considered in this calculus. Otherwise, it's just not going to work.
I was happy to see that your report acknowledged the need for the market access and pipelines for our oil and gas industry, and pointing out that Canada needs to have that so that they can have the money to invest in the transition. Can you talk a little bit about the discussion among the authors on that point?
Yeah, we had a lot of discussion, and we're thinking, what are the things that the oil and gas industry needs to do to be successful? And I think you've, on your podcast, talked about the need for them to be cost competitive and clean. And that's, so one of the things would be the transparency. There's a commitment. You know, make sure that you're committing to responsible investment and that there's transparency to reinforce that. But also, you know, the fact that they have to be profitable to actually invest back into making things even cleaner. And without market access, that's difficult to do. And so we saw that, you know, and it doesn't help climate change. It's actually what would help climate change is them investing into, you know, better processes, more technology to actually tackle the emissions problem and become even a better, more responsible oil and gas producer.
Yeah, like if you're barely getting by, you're not going to have any money to invest in becoming, you know, way lower carbon. So I think it was a great recommendation
by the report. And no one's
going
to lend to you, and your investors will not want to buy your equity. And so it has a lot of ripple effects.
Mm-hmm. The report has been lauded by the federal government and other groups, and I really do encourage our audience to take a look at it. Again, we're going to post the link on our site, and it's really worth a look.
Yeah, I think it's a must read. If you're in this area of energy and investing in Canada, like, you have to read it.
Yeah.
Congratulations to you and all the authors on what was, I think, more than a year in the making. Is that right?
That's right. And it was April 2018. But thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. And I know the panel does as well. And, you know, big part of this process was to get feedback from across Canada. And I'd like to thank everybody who took their time. We got very informative feedback. People were really gracious with their thoughts. And so I'd like to thank everyone. And, you know, as people read the final report, we're open to hearing more. You can check the website where the report is linked, or you just can email me at barbara_zavan@otpp.com, and I'd love to hear your thoughts as we move forward.
And that's _Zavan, Z-V-A-N, right?
Correct.
Great. Well, thanks for joining our podcast, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. If you like this podcast, please rate us on the app that you're on and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.